Hello and welcome to this podcast from Polity, part of a series of interviews with some of the major authors in the Polity list. My name is George Miller, and I'm very pleased to say that my guest on this programme is Alex Kalinikos, who is Professor of European Studies at King's College London and a leading Marxist thinker, whose works include The Revolutionary Ideas of Karl Marx, Against Postmodernism, and An Anti-Capitalist Manifesto. Alex's most recent book, published earlier this year, is called Bonfire of Illusions, The Twin Crises of the Liberal World, and it was to discuss this book that I visited Alex at King's College in August this year. Since Alex's thesis is that two major challenges to the hegemony of Western liberal capitalism occurred in 2008, a financial one typified by the collapse of Lehman Brothers, and a geopolitical one, the war between Russia and Georgia, this interview falls into two parts. In the first part, we discuss a financial crisis, and in the second, the shifting of the tectonic plates in geopolitics. I began the interview by remarking that I had been struck by a quotation from Slavoj Žižek in Alex's book, which highlighted the importance of whose version of the narrative came to prevail. Žižek writes, "To put it in old-fashioned Marxist terms, the main task of the ruling ideology in the present crisis is to impose a narrative that will not put the blame for the meltdown on the global capitalist system as such, but on its deviations, lax regulation, the corruption of big financial institutions, etc. The danger is thus that the predominant narrative of the meltdown won't be the one that awakes us from a dream, but the one that will enable us to continue to dream." I put it to Alex that neoliberal capitalism seemed at the moment to be winning the battle for the control of the narrative.
I think to an extent that would have surprised a lot of people, including myself, at the height of the financial crash, the end of 2008. I think it's certainly true that at the minute neoliberalism is making the running, or to be more precise, the kind of social and political coalition of forces that, for various reasons, have an interest in sustaining neoliberalism as an ideology and a policy regime, are making the running. I suppose in one sense that's not very surprising, since they're in power, which does give them an advantage.
And it seemed to me that that quotation tied up very neatly with, or had an echo in, a quotation from Marx, in which he said, the difficulty with removing people's illusions about their condition is that those illusions really are constituents of that very condition.
The illusions aren't sustained primarily intellectually, so they're not amenable simply to some sort of theoretical or empirical demonstration that they're false. They're sustained by and help to sustain certain social realities. And I think it's clear that's true of neoliberalism, yeah.
Maybe you could just explain what those illusions are then, which go onto your bonfire.
Okay. The illusions are essentially the idea which took shape after 1989, that Western liberal capitalism provided the best framework for managing the world both economically and politically. So there are really two constituents to the ideology, although they're closely related. One is some version of neoliberalism. In other words, the idea that a market as little regulated or controlled as possible is the best framework for achieving or maximizing prosperity and well-being and so on. The second constituent is that the kind of geopolitical order that the US constructed after the Second World War in the West, understood to include not just the US and Western Europe, but Japan as well, provides the best framework for managing the world as it emerged from the collapse of the communist regimes. So those are the primary illusions that certainly, I think, were thrown into crisis in the past few years.
But as you say very honestly in your prologue, they haven't been consumed by the bonfire. To mix metaphors, neoliberal capitalism has steamed on almost regardless.
I do say that for the reasons that we discussed a minute ago. But I think it's very important to qualify it. Neoliberalism, capitalism, as an economic subsystem of capitalism, now stumbles along, held up by the crutch of the state. What happened in the autumn of 2008, after the collapse of Lehman Brothers and the financial crash it precipitated, were the biggest nationalizations in the world, in world history. In the US, Britain and the Eurozone, something like the equivalent of $14 trillion were spent rescuing the banks and so on and so forth. And we're talking in August 2010, very recent developments, announcements by both the US Federal Reserve and the Bank of England, which demonstrate the extent to which particularly the financial system is still dependent on the crutch of the state. So there was always a gap between ideology and reality in the case of neoliberalism. The gap is much greater. Secondly, when I talked about the other constituent illusion, which was to do with the kind of the US-dominated liberal geopolitical order, I think what I argued about its weakening stands up pretty well. I mean, the incident that I used to draw this out was the war between Russia and Georgia, which wasn't just a border dispute. The war 2 years ago in August 2008, it was to do with the US, with Russia saying they were prepared to go to war to stop the expansion of NATO to their borders. They were successful in that. The project of incorporating Georgia and Ukraine in NATO is dead. And more broadly, the kind of world we live in is inhabited by an enormous amount of chatter, some of it low grade, some of it high grade. A big element of the high grade chatter is about the BRICS, in other words, the emergent market economies, the big developing economies of the global south, most importantly China, but there are a number of other examples such as India and Brazil, and the extent to which their ability relatively robustly to cope with the economic crisis is being taken as further signs of the decline of the West in general and of the US in particular is very striking and supports my general thesis. So I don't think it holds up that badly.
Going back to the financial crisis, I suppose where your analysis differs from what people might read in their morning newspapers is that you contend that it's not simply an aberration which can be put right with better regulation, which is the sort of prevailing discourse, but in fact points up something systemic, something which is inherent in the capitalist system, something about its nature, if you like.
Yes, the roots of the crisis are systemic, but in a complicated way. I wouldn't argue that it's impossible to have a much more tightly regulated banking sector than exists today, because if we look at what happened to the banks after the last great financial crash in 1929, the result was very high degree of regulation. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when in the late 1960s, if you went abroad, you could take no more than £50 sterling. In other words, there were very tight restrictions over the movement of capital across borders and things like that. That's feasible in principle. And I don't really believe the arguments that are made to the effect that economic globalization has made such controls impossible. For example, China maintains them fairly efficiently from what one can tell. But I think what is the case is that since the late 1960s, the advanced capitalist economies have been suffering from protracted problems of low profitability. Neoliberalism, more than anything else, was an attempt to overcome those problems, to put it crudely, by forcing down wages and forcing up profits, what David Harvey calls a restoration of class power. And neoliberalism was successful in that, but not sufficiently to restore profitability to the kind of levels that it was at during the post-war boom in the 50s and 60s. And what I think has happened is that what's called financialization, in other words, the development of a much more autonomous and much more pervasive financial sector. Look at the way in which all of us are tied up with the credit system in different ways through credit cards and mortgages. Financialization has to be seen as a way of sustaining a decent rate of economic growth in the absence of robust underlying profitability. So that's the sense in which I'd say the crisis has systemic roots. There are systemic problems of overaccumulation and profitability, and financialization has, it wasn't planned, it wasn't a plot, but it developed into the mechanism for sustaining growth in the absence of more favourable underlying conditions of profitability.
As I read your pages on financialization, the adjective that sprang to my mind was tentacular. It seemed as though the financial system had had reached and found its way into all sorts of crevices and places where it hadn't been before.
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. And there's more and more evidence of it. I mean, the Financial Times a few months ago had a fantastic article on the way in which the big Wall Street banks had managed to sell Italian municipal authorities all sorts of dodgy financial derivatives, as a result of which those municipal authorities had now lost enormous amounts of money. It's quite good to be able to outwit the Italian political elite. They're not normally regarded as dumb. No, I think that we're talking about an extraordinarily pervasive and extraordinarily unscrupulous setup. The sheer ruthlessness with which the major, particularly American, but not exclusively American, European as well, banks seize any opportunity to squeeze out a bit of profit is very striking. It's also striking how powerful they are. So far, they've been largely successful in seeing off the attempts more strictly to regulate them, the kind of capital rules that they're supposed to be subjected to by the Bank for International Settlements turn out to be much kinder than was thought. One of the things that they were most frightened of, which was a return to the arrangement in the US whereby investment and commercial banking were kept separate, that isn't going to happen now, and so on. That's one of the most striking features of the crisis, how powerful the banks have emerged. Simon Johnson, former chief economist of the International Monetary Fund and a very mainstream economist, said that the United States is like a third world country with its own oligarchy where, as you put it, economic and political tentacles are interwoven. But the core of that oligarchy, he says, is on Wall Street.
Now, another way in which you want to challenge the prevailing narrative is you say there's been a lot of chatter about the crisis being caused because, in inverted commas, we have spent too much and borrowed too much. Yeah. And you say, well, that's really only part of the story. And you go on to open up other aspects of what's happened in the last few decades.
Yes, I mean, it's a very, very striking about the United States, which is still the biggest and richest economy in the world, that if you look at real household income, it has stagnated since the late 1970s. There are various ways in which households have coped. In particular, I think the rise of women's participation in the workforce has helped to keep people afloat. But even so, then the overall effect has been that incomes have stagnated. This reflects the power of neoliberalism in forcing down wages. And what that means is that the kinds of credit that have become much more pervasive, mortgages, consumer credit through credit cards and things like that, aren't ways in which people, or most people, buy into the good life, you know, or anything like that. It's much more a way of keeping afloat. People are borrowing money in order to pay the groceries, not in order to have holidays in the Bahamas.
You quote Martin Wolf from the FT at one point saying capitalism is dead, long live capitalism. But in fact, part of the thrust of your book is this is an opportunity to re-examine alternatives, not just a modified version of what went before.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's for two reasons. First of all, for the kind of reasons that we've been discussing, in particular the entrenched power of the banks, it doesn't look like we're going to get a more regulated version of capitalism. What we're getting is a bizarre hybrid in which neoliberalism, in as much as it meant money-making by the banks and widening differences between rich and poor, continues to flourish, but with massive state support. I should just say this is something that lots of people who support neoliberalism recognize and are worried about. That's one of the things that is driving the austerity moves towards greater austerity through cutting back public spending and so on and so forth. Anyway, it doesn't look that we're going to get a more satisfactory version of capitalism out of the crisis. Secondly, because, as we've been discussing, the roots of the crisis were systemic, they weren't simply to do with a particular regime of regulation or regime of accumulation or whatever, but relate to deep-seated conflicts, contradictions, to use Marx's word, within capitalism as an economic system, it does seem appropriate to be thinking about alternatives to capitalism altogether. Now, that's a difficult subject because lots of people think that 1989 meant that that was a closed book. But I think that's really silly. Just because one purported version of socialism failed that had developed in very problematic conditions in quite poor countries doesn't mean that any modern alternative to capitalism is off the agenda.
That's the end of part one of this interview with Alex Kalinikos, in which we've been talking about his recent book, Bonfire of Illusions. I do hope you'll join me for part two, in which we look at the second of the twin crises he identifies, this one situated in geopolitics. Until then, thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.